This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Growing threat to the economy. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
The economy is humming along, but one analyst says we're in a debt bubble, and at some point, it's going to burst.
Apple is promising more protection for its new iPhones, but can they survive being submerged in soda or coffee?
A church in Australia tried to simplify the donation process, but when it used Facebook to announce electronic collection plates, reaction was harsh.
And professional athletes who complain about the way they're ranked in video games.
Their family members play the video games, their friends play the video games, so they'll come home from practice and be like, I would pick your character for my virtual team, but he's too slow. You know, if you want your friends and family to be playing your character, and if your character is rated slowly, you're not going to perform well in the video game.
Makes for an awkward Thanksgiving dinner conversation, right? Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Needleman on the lengths athletes will go to in order to improve their own video game selves. That story is later in the hour. As the midterm elections approach, America's electronic voting systems are more vulnerable than ever. What's being done to fix them? We're joined now by cybersecurity journalist Kim Zetter, who's got a piece running in the New York Times. Kim, what's the current security level?
It's really what I would refer to as Band-Aid security. Mm. So we're really not in much of a different shape than we were in 2016. There are some differences, some changes, but certainly not what you would want.
Wow. What are the Band-Aids, by the way? Let's work backwards, I guess.
So what DHS did prior to 2016 is it reached out to states and it offered this scanning service that it does. What this means is it simply will scan the internet-facing system. So these were the servers like the voter registration databases, things like that. Anything that's online, DHS will do this remote scan. And all it's doing is looking to see if you have any open software vulnerabilities that are known, software vulnerabilities that we know about that also have a patch available. And it will tell the states where it's found a vulnerability, and it will keep scanning. They will keep scanning, like on a weekly basis, on a biweekly basis, to see when the customer has patched that system. So they did that to a few states before the 2016 election, and then they've done that to more states or more counties now since then. But it's still the amount is, I think it's less than half. And the scanning is really sort of cosmetic. It's getting at only the internet-facing systems. It's not getting at the core back-end systems that are supposedly not connected to the internet. So it's not getting at the voting machines at all. It's not looking at the core vulnerabilities there. And it's also not touching what are the election management systems. And these are the systems that sit in a county headquarters. They are used to program the voting machines, and they are also used to tabulate the votes. So these are actually the most critical systems, not the internet-facing system.
Okay, so if you're an average voter, do you walk into a polling place in November with the utmost confidence, or are you saying there are some doubts here about whether or not we could be hacked?
There has always been the possibility for our election systems to be hacked, going back 15, 16 years since many of these systems were implemented. We're just addressing it now because of the Russian threat. But the situation is not new. I would not tell voters not to vote. Definitely, I want voters to go out and vote as you did before. The problem is not the voters' problem. The problem is the back end. States and counties need to implement mandatory audits, and they need to have paper trails, either a paper ballot the voter fills out or have the machine produce paper trail. And they need to do a manual audit of those against the digital vote. It's not up to the voter here, and I don't want voters to come away with the wrong message that they shouldn't vote.
As you point out, there's really two types of voting machines in use. Do they provide that type of backup?
So many states have recognizing this problem, obviously, that digital ballots or digital votes can be altered, have mandated. California, Ohio, Florida, for example, mandated years ago that their machines have to have, they either need optical scan machines where the voter fills out a full-size paper ballot that gets scanned into machine, or the fully electronic machine has to produce a paper trail. So many states and many voters are now voting on these systems. The problem is that states and county election officials are not looking at that paper after the election is over in many cases.
Mm. We're speaking with Kim Zetter, veteran cybersecurity journalist, also author of a book called Countdown to Zero Day. She's got a piece running in the New York Times entitled The Crisis of Election Security. How did we get so vulnerable?
Oh, we got vulnerable because of a reaction to the Florida fiasco in the 2000 presidential election. In that case, I'm sure everyone recalls the dangling Chad.
Wow, yeah.
That took, you know, the race to the Supreme Court, and lawmakers in Washington, D.C. decided that they didn't want that to happen again, and they thought they came to the wrong conclusion that it was the paper ballots that were the problem and not the fact that we didn't actually do a recount, a manual recount. And so what they did was they set up legislation that was designed to get rid of those systems, and many states overreacted and went to systems that didn't have any paper at all. And that's how we got the system where we have today.
How about like in the coming years? Do you get the sense that we won't have as many issues as we have now?
I think the problem is that we have had this up for a bill. A bill has come into Congress since, let's see, four or five times since this all happened in 2000, trying to mandate paper backups and audits in systems, and lawmakers do not pick it up. There's been absolutely no interest, and it's been primarily because it's the houses are controlled by Republicans. We're having again this year, there's another bill introduced that would exactly do the same thing again, mandate paper and also audits, and it hasn't gone anywhere.
Thanks, Kim. Kim Zetter, cybersecurity journalist. Her piece running in the New York Times. It is 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. FMLA, FLSA, ACA, EEOC. It's harder than ever for businesses to keep up with today's evolving alphabet soup of regulations. What's a company to do? Kronos. With Kronos, you can minimize compliance risk and track HR policies, making sure they are applied consistently and fairly. HR, payroll, talent, and timekeeping in one unified system, all with a proven implementation approach and simplified, transparent pricing. Learn more at kronos.com/compliance. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. First full weekend in October. Glad you could share it with us. Serious subject here. Why are sexual assault victims not always willing to come forward? The reasons are many. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
The heated national debate about sexual misconduct has cast a spotlight on victims' reluctance to report assault. Here with more on their complex reasons is Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal. Elizabeth, what do the numbers tell us first about how many people actually report attacks to law enforcement?
So the numbers have been pretty steady for many years, decades. They're showing that about 5 to 20% of victims do report to law enforcement. So that's a very small amount. It's even smaller on college campuses. About 90% of victims do not report on college campuses.
All right, Elizabeth, let's talk about some of the specifics. What are some of the factors you found in your research about why people are not coming forward?
It's very complex. So many reasons why somebody might not report an assault or a rape. It can be re-traumatizing to revisit that, to tell people, go over the details again. And once you tell somebody, once this law enforcement system takes over, you lose control. And this is a primary issue of why the rape or the assault itself was so traumatizing. You've lost control of your body, right? So now you send it out there, you're telling people, justice system is taking over. You've lost control of that again, and that also can be re-traumatizing.
Elizabeth, why do so many victims blame themselves?
Well, we are in this long-standing culture of sort of blaming the victim, and unfortunately victims know this, and so there's a deep amount of shame. Often, you know, people were in a position, not often, but sometimes they're somewhere or they feel that they did something wrong. I went to that party. I had too many drinks. I walked down that street that was dark. These should be things that anybody can do and still be safe. You should be safe in this world, right, in a perfect world, but we're not. And so there's this self-blame, like, how did I not protect myself?
We're speaking with Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal. Elizabeth, your article, I thought it was interesting that people are more willing to come forward if there's some evidence of physical harm. Why is that?
Well, because then they feel like they will be believed. So the huge fear is that I am going to put myself out there. I'm going to relive my trauma, and I'm going to do it publicly. People now know these shameful details. It's, you know, sex is a private thing to begin with, even when it's consensual and nice. So people are going to know these horrible details of my life, and no one's going to believe me, right? So these physical injuries that somebody has are at least physical proof. They're visible proof that something happened to me.
Let's talk about the victims who actually know the person, which seems to be somewhat often. If that person is a friend, a relative, something like that, does that make it that much more complicated?
Yes, especially, you know, for young people, you're on a college campus or high school, you see this person in the halls, you see this person around at the country club, wherever you are. And so you're scared, A, that they will get angry at you and there'll be some retaliation, but you're also scared of being ostracized. So, you know, will people, again, in this victim-blaming society, will people say that, you know, you should be quiet? And here's the thing. There's something called cognitive dissonance. When something, we can't get our mind around something. So someone says, hey, this person you know assaulted me. What if we know that person to be a really good person? So now I can't get I can't get my mind around the idea that this person that I know to be upstanding in the community, suddenly something horrible is being said he did. And so I can't get my mind around it. The way I try to jibe that is these must be lies. This must be an exaggeration or made up.
Let's turn this around a little bit and talk about the parent's role, especially if this involves someone who's a teenager or a college student. What should a parent be doing and saying?
So we can talk to our children. We can make sure they know that this is, of course, not at all okay. And we can talk to our boys, too, and really talk more about consent, that sexual activity is not about conquest. It's not about bragging. It's about respect of both people and mutual consent. And we can talk about what consent means. No means no. Silence is not a yes. Silence is a no. So in the absence of a yes, nothing should happen, right? So we can talk about that. We can also tell boys, look, boys get assaulted too. We never talk about that. But they need to understand that they can say no too, that boys are not expected to just have sex at will. So they can say no. And we can talk to them also about if they see something, if they see another person committing some kind of act, that they should intervene, you know, so that they shouldn't just be standbyers who watch. Or don't say anything. So we can have these conversations.
That is this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein. 22 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Well, a wet iPhone doesn't mean a dead iPhone anymore. All the iPhones dating to the iPhone 7 have been water resistant, meaning if you accidentally drop the device into a pool or puddle, your handset will almost certainly survive. With the new iPhone XS and XS Max, Apple promises something more, models that can resist accidental spills of other liquids, from fizzy soda to bubbly alcoholic beverages. USA Today personal technology columnist Ed Baig tested a new iPhone in all those liquids. Ed, explain the experiment.
We dropped an iPhone XS into a bucket, or actually, I guess, a pitcher of the various liquids. We wanted to see if we can get the iPhone drunk, so we put it in with beer, and we have bubbly wine and coffee and Coca-Cola, and guess what? It worked. The phone continued to work after each spill.
What did you find, that there were any kind of limits to this?
Not really. I mean, technically there are limits. I mean, you know, there's something called IP68, which is basically a standard, which basically means that if the phone that meets that standard can be submerged in fresh water for up to 2 meters for up to a half hour. Mm. Now, you know, we didn't keep the iPhone in the Coke, for example, or the beer for more than a couple of minutes. Really, not even that. So in that sense, I guess, Think about it in real world terms. If you are sitting on your desk and you spill coffee on it, yeah. What are you going to do? You're going to dry it off immediately. And that's what you're supposed to do, by the way.
We're speaking with Ed Baig at USA Today. He drowned the iPhone in a bunch of liquids to see how it would hold up. It's an important distinction you make because water resistant does not mean waterproof.
Correct. And technically, you're not supposed to swim with these. I do know people who do. And they've come out fine, but, you know, Apple will not tell you to do that, and I'm certainly not telling you to do that. I mean, the idea is really to prevent an accident, you know.
Yeah.
You drop it in a puddle or by the seashore and suddenly a big wave comes and hits it. It's that kind of thing. You're not meant to swim with it, though, as I said, technically you can keep the phone, at least the standard tells you, you can keep the phone in fresh water for up to about 2 meters for a half hour. So I guess you could swim in it under those circumstances.
Are the phones more durable than they've been, or is this a standard we've been carrying around for some time?
Well, we've heard it before, but Apple says yes, indeed, that this is the most durable glass they've ever put on an iPhone. I did not do drop tests. I know a couple of people who did, and some people reported no problems. There were a couple of scuff marks, a couple of people I talked to. Again, Apple claims it's the most durable, but it doesn't necessarily mean shatterproof. So, my advice is don't push it to the limit.
Yeah. When you're drying the thing out, is it best to stand it upright so maybe or sideways so that the moisture can leak out of whatever buttons or holes might be in it?
I don't know if there's a standard way to dry it. I mean, I literally just took a paper towel and dried it that way. I didn't do anything particularly scientific here. And again, it was fine. And we did douse the thing. You know, there's pictures. If you direct people to the article at usatoday.com/tech, you'll see the video of what we did. And you'll see that, it was fully doused in these various liquids. But we dried it just the old-fashioned way with a paper towel.
Ed Baig, USA Today personal technology columnist. By the way, he says, if you read the fine print, liquid damage is not covered under Apple's warranty. So repeat that test that he did at your own peril, especially since you spent $1,000 or more to get the phone. He says, also, if your phone does get wet, wipe it dry immediately and don't try to charge it before it's dry. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and advanced manufacturing. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org.
Cutting through the clutter to bring you the people and stories that matter to you. You're listening to America's First News, This Weekend with Gordon Deal.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Coming up this half hour, spotting fake online reviews. Also, pro athletes who whine about wanting faster, stronger video game doubles and what they do about it. And the Australian church catching hell after introducing electronic collection plates. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 most improved state for business, Michigan. Contact MichiganBusiness.org today. Credit scores have hit new highs. We're buying more, and stocks keep rising. Life is good, right? But could it be too good? Yes, says Sanford Kahn, economic business trends analyst. He shakes his head at the amount of debt that we've accumulated. He's based in Long Beach, California. Sanford, what kind of economy are we looking at?
Well, we're looking at an economy that's doing well. I can't argue with the numbers. It's doing well. But we're in a debt bubble economy, and all bubbles eventually burst. You cannot keep going. Economy can't keep going by adding more debt faster than the economy is growing, and that's exactly what we're doing. And the quality of the debt now is actually worse than it was at the peak in 2007, right before we had the financial crisis. So we got a real problem now. You got a debt-induced financial bubble. And, how much do you think this thing's going to go on forever? Of course not. No bubbles go on forever. They all burst. I can't tell you when, but no one could tell you when. Right. That's ridiculous.
The debt, it's government and consumers, or are we just talking about bad consumer debt here?
Oh, it's both. I'll give you an example. All debt, both municipalities and corporations, the debt now, over a little over 50% of the debt from municipalities, that would be like government, states, and corporate debt, a little over 50% is rated junk or one notch above junk. When, to me, that's all junk. In 2007, about 27% of that debt was rated junk or one notch above junk. So, you know, you take your pick. We're worse off now than we were in 2007, and those people get into bond funds. Better be careful about the rating on those bonds, because a lot of those bonds are very low rated. They could be junk or a little bit above junk. And if they're a little bit above junk, they're called investment grade. But to me, if you're a little bit above junk, it's junk.
How did we find these new depths? What happened?
After we climbed these new depths? What was the question again?
How did we find them? How did we get back to worse than we were in 07?
But because the Fed lowered interest rates to near zero for a number of years. So people went out and borrowed money like mad. They issued debt, and they just had a debt-induced financial bubble, and the economy did grow, and it worked. But all trends come to an end. They don't go on forever. Now the Fed is reversing itself, and guess what? Interest rates are going up. The 10-year Treasury note went above 3%. It still is above 3%. If it starts climbing higher, well, God, you people borrowed money at low interest rates. Now rates are going up. That'll prick the financial bubble, especially if the yield on the 10-year Treasury note goes above 3.25%, and if it starts going to 4%, the game is over. That's it. The game, all financial games come to an end, and this one eventually will come to an end too. So it's a matter of whether you're going to be caught in the middle. So start preparing for yourself now, because this thing will not last forever.
Hey, Sanford Khan, economic business trends analyst from California. 22 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. Ever felt like the online review of a product didn't pass the smell test? Katie Hill at moneyish.com has put together a list of ways to spot fake reviews. Katie, what about these bogus ones?
A lot of them are fake. It's really hard these days to tell. I mean, it used to be easier, right? You would just see something, it was garbled, it just had 5 stars and it was garbled, and you knew that was fake. That's not really true anymore. There's now people hired to just write reviews, and they're getting very good at it. But there was a survey that found that about 8 in 10 people say that they've read a fake review in the past year, and 84% of them say, hey, I don't even know if I can always spot a fake review. So I just thought, you know, this is an opportunity to really dig into what does the research show and what experts say about spotting fake reviews. So the first one, which I'm not sure I realize, but examine the timing of reviews. So if you see a lot, you're looking at a product, Amazon, wherever you're looking at it, and you see a lot of reviews pop in a short amount of time, that can be a sign that those are fake reviews. That's because there's a lot of times there's a targeted campaign to add a bunch of new reviews, and it often happens in a short amount of time. So if you see a whole bunch clustered together, that could be fake. I mean, of course, if the product just launched and it was Black Friday or Christmas or something like that, that might be why there's a lot at the same time. But again, just be suspicious about that.
How about the this accusation or the investigation that Amazon's doing that there were payoffs?
Right.
For people to delete bad reviews? Oh, my goodness.
Right. So that they're investigating that. We're not entirely sure if that actually happened, but they are investigating that. They were that some of its employees, mostly in China, were taking bribes to delete negative reviews and share sales data, unban banned accounts. There was a bunch of that. Now, they're investigating it. We don't know if it's true or not. But, you know, I mean, immediately when I read that, I thought, wow, there's a lot of fake reviews. Who knows what's going on here? But it's a problem because people rely on reviews to you know, what they buy. And if they're fake, I mean, you're buying a product that you're not going to like when it ends up in your house.
Wow. We're speaking with Katie Hill, editor at moneyish.com. We're talking about how to spot fake reviews online. All right, another way, you said overuse of the words I and me and lots of verbs?
Yeah, this was a huge study coming out of Cornell that found that online reviews that frequently use I and me are more likely to be fake. They don't exactly know why, but it could be because when people are lying, they try to make themselves sound more credible by using personal pronouns. So they're saying I and me to make it seem like they're the real person, you know, doing this. And then they also found that deceivers use more verbs and they use more verbs than truth tellers, and truth tellers use more nouns. That's a little bit harder, I think, to parse out. But the I and the me, if you see a whole bunch of that, that's a little bit of a red flag.
What's this scene setting you got to watch out for?
This is another thing from the big Cornell study. Okay, so this one was looking at hotel reviews in particular, but I think it probably applies to everything. So truthful hotel reviews are more likely to use concrete words. So they'll say something like bathroom, check-in, you know, very concrete things. People who are lying, the fake reviews, they were more like setting a scene like, well, I was on vacation or on a business trip or with my husband, whereas the other ones like, the bathroom's nice, it has white tile. You know, those specific details, those are more likely to be true.
Thanks, Katie. Katie Hill, editor at moneyish.com. It's 15 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. Sports video games have zero impact on pro careers, but athletes say they can't help but care about how they're portrayed. Each year, sports video game developers strive to capture the on-field talent of hundreds of athletes in their games, giving them numerical ratings for player skills. And each year, athletes whine about it on Twitter. And to Dustin Smith, the guy who sets the ratings for players in the video game Madden NFL. Funny story by Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Needleman. Sarah, what'd you find?
They're rated in the games, and depending on their rating, that's how well they perform in the video games. And so they want to see if their scores reflect how good they are on the field or the court in real life. And sometimes they really work hard at lobbying the video game company's rating czars to get, you know, higher scores. And sometimes they're not happy with how they look either. They want their avatars to be more attractive.
Explain the extent to which they lobby.
Well, they will use social media. They'll send private messages on Instagram or text message to the rating czars. And some of them have even, you know, dangled some offers. I'll give you a high-end pair of collectible sneakers in exchange for a higher rating. They'll say, I deserve a higher rating. The rating czar says, oh, yeah, prove it. And so the athlete will go ahead and send clips of themselves running or throwing or whatever it is to prove that they deserve higher scores. And then there's the case with, you know, the ratings are Electronic Arts, as he told me, stupidly gave out his cell phone number to Orleans Dwarkwa, who is he's a free agent now, but he played for the New York Giants last year. Well, Orleans is like a serial texter. He texts the guy, you know, every season before the, you know, right before the season gets underway, and then throughout the season 2 to 3 times, saying, make sure, you know, you bump up my score. And he really lets the guy have it.
That's funny. Why do these athletes care so much? It's a video game.
Well, look, right. I mean, you're right. It's a video game. It has zero impact on their careers. But keep in mind, first of all, these are uber competitive people. You don't get to the NFL if you're not a competitive person to begin with.
Right.
And, you know, these video games have been around a long time. Madden NFL is 3 decades old. And some of these guys grew up playing the video game. So imagine playing a video game, and then you get ahead in your career, and you make it all the way to the NFL, and then now you're in the video game. So it's a huge honor, but at the same time, you want your ratings in that game to reflect how hard you work in real life on the field. So if you think that the score that the game video game is giving you doesn't line up with your expertise on the field, you might want to say something.
That's funny. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal tech reporter Sarah Needleman. She's got a great story about how pro athletes beg and whine for faster, stronger video game doubles. I got a chuckle, too, out of Tony Jefferson, the safety for the Baltimore Ravens, who gets complaints from his little brother about how slow he is.
Yeah. Like, I mean, all their family members play the video games, their friends play the video games, so they'll come home from practice and be like, oh, you know, I would pick your character from my virtual team, but he's too slow. I know, and they're like, what? You know, if you want your friends and family to be playing your character, and if your character is rated slowly, you're not going to perform well in the video games.
Explain the couple of guys you talked to at the end of the story who didn't like the way they looked.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting, this year in Madden NFL, a lot of the characters are shown without their helmets on, so you see their faces. And not every athlete in the NFL has been fully scanned into the game. Like, they have some pretty impressive technology for scanning players and do 3D modeling and all that to make them look very, very realistic. But not every player has gone through that process yet. And so Christian Covington and Tyrone Crawford, for example, did not have that scanning completion completely done yet. And so their avatars look kind of generic and not so good. They just don't make the guys, they don't look like the real guys. And they both of them let them have it. They drummed up sympathy on Twitter and said, oh, man, I look so ugly, or just, you know, I look like Humpty Dumpty. And I got tons of retweets and tons of likes. And the rating czar at EA saw it and said, okay, we'll try and fix you and make you look more handsome.
It's Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Needleman. The best quote in her story is from Christian Covington, defensive end for the Houston Texans, who said, quote, I looked like a thumb, a bald, sweaty, glistening thumb. So finally today, St. Mary's Cathedral in Australia is taking heat for implementing a tap-and-go collection plate, similar to what you would see at a McDonald's. These devices allow patrons, or in this case parishioners, to tap their chip-enabled credit cards and pay a certain amount. The Huffington Post says the Roman Catholic Cathedral in Sydney announced the move on its Facebook page, but the outcry was so swift that the post was quickly deleted. The post read, multiple payments of $10 can be made by tapping your card once with several seconds in between each transaction. Multiple payments, wow. The response was certainly not all negative and seemed more focused on the minimum donation being set at $10. One poster wrote, if you had made it a $2 minimum, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation. Another wrote about not carrying much cash these days and said, I would love this option at my parish. St. Mary's followed up on the outcry by thanking those who made, quote, rational and coherent comments about the new collection plates. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.